Welcome to Funding and Disrupting, the most in-depth business podcast for technology companies looking to raise capital and the venture capital firms that fund them. We interview venture capital firm managing partners and tech company founders to get the real story of how it all came together. If you're searching for funding for a disruptive or innovative technology, or you're searching for the best companies to invest in, then you've come to the right place. Now, let's get funding and disrupting with our host, Keith Herman.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Keith Herman, and welcome to today's episode of Funding and Disrupting. Today, my special guest is Kyle York, the co-founder and CEO, managing partner of York IE. York invests at early stage through Series A startups. They're also primarily focused on business-to-business subscription and software as a service companies. So let's get straight to it and welcome Kyle York. How are you, Kyle?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Keith.
Sure. Kyle, why don't you tell us where you are today?
Yeah, so I am, our offices are based in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm working from home today. In Bedford, New Hampshire. So we're about an hour north of Boston on the East Coast. This is where I'm actually from and where we've chosen to build our company here. So excited to talk to you all the way from the Granite State. Maybe I'm your first podcast guest from New Hampshire.
Yes, you are. And I want to learn more about that. Why don't you tell us what it was like growing up? I grew up in the Northeast also. You were further north. Why don't you share with us what your experience was like growing up there and what were some of your interests growing up as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up here. I'm the middle child of five sons. So my parents had five boys. And so, you know, and I'm middle child syndrome to the max, as you can imagine. We all grew up playing sports. Our family business as kids was actually a sporting goods retailer. So my dad and mom, you know, all the equipment, uniforms for all the local little leagues and football teams and high schools and colleges. So kind of, you know, growing up with five boys in a small entrepreneurial business focused on sports, as you can imagine, was a competitive environment and a really fun and thrilling upbringing. I always loved New Hampshire. You know, New Hampshire's state motto is to live free or die. State. So, you know, we have a really entrepreneurial spirit. You know, all the New England states are super close to one another. So, you know, getting to Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts or Rhode Island or Connecticut is a short drive for some in the Midwest or, you know, the West Coast. They sometimes can't believe that it takes me 45 minutes to go to a Red Sox game from where I live. And, you know, we grew up with the four seasons. So we're in November now as we're recording this podcast and starting to get a little colder, you know, and the snow's coming. But you know, it's great in New Hampshire because you really appreciate the seasons and kind of have different activities throughout each season as well. So we're just about to get into ski mode and all that. So yeah, growing up here was, again, just a really great experience. I did move away. You know, I went to school outside Boston and ended up moving to California. So, I've been on the road a lot for my career, but I've seen all places.
Where did you go to college and what did you study there?
Yeah, I went to Bentley University in Waltham, Mass, business school. I studied marketing and minored in management. I also played college football. So it's a Division II football school. So I played football there, defensive back. So yeah, I mean, I learned a lot. I mean, it's one of the best schools for undergrad business degrees in the country. And it's 10 minutes from Boston, right? So it's a city in and of itself, but it's also right connected into Boston, which was really an awesome college experience.
Yeah, they're actually, Waltham is known for watches. I don't know if you know the Waltham
watch. Yeah, it's like, I mean, what I remember that is absolutely spot on. And there was actually like a brewery when we were in college called like Watch City Brewing. I'm not sure it's still there, right on Moody Street in Waltham. But yeah, in a lot of those mill buildings had a very similar feel to the Manchester Mill Yard where our headquarters are, which was predominantly textiles and footwear and things like that back in the kind of industrial times. So a lot of the cities in New England are like those mill buildings on a river that have now all been turned into really cool commercial and residential establishments. So it's pretty cool types of office settings too.
Yeah, it's great. I love the history there. So why don't you explain to us a little bit about your career path from, let's say, going from college to York IE?
Yeah, so it's been a pretty fun ride. I mean, we founded York IE in 2019, and I got out of school kind of early 2000s. I ended up kind of getting lucky. I interned, you know, while at Bentley for a software company that at the time was making a transition from the licensed software model, licensed software maintenance to subscription to SaaS. And so my first job as an intern was putting together our playbook to call customers and get to convert to the new business model and to the new tech platform. So it kind of dates myself, but my entire career has been in that SaaS, you know, business model. And it's what I know. Customer acquisition, delighting your customers, expanding those relationships. And I climbed the corporate ladder for that first startup that was focused on education technology. So it was an ed tech company. They sold private school software. It was called Whipple Hill. The company eventually sold to Blackbaud, which is a public nonprofit software company. I actually moved to California for them. I lived in San Diego for a while on the West Coast. And have always kind of been in sales and marketing roles and grew into a sales and marketing leader. I was recruited back to New Hampshire. I don't think I expected, you know, going to school right outside Boston, then moving to California early in my career necessarily to end up right back in my hometown. But I was recruited by a high school classmate who had co-founded a company called Dyne, D-Y-N. And Dyne at the time was a, you know, consumer app that allowed you to have like keithshouse.com and you could log back into your home network. I mean, think before, you know, iPhones and Nest cams and, you know, you wanted to access back to your remote, you know, server at your house. And so that's what the company Dyne was originally founded as. A lot of tech nerds would remember Dyne DNS, which was the name, domain name system. And then we ended up taking that company to the enterprise and using the domain name system, the DNS, to help hyperscale web brands build up their infrastructure globally and ensure excellent performance to their end customers. And so I joined that company. It was 15 employees. We took it to 500 people. I was chief revenue officer along the way. We scaled it to 100 million of recurring revenue. And we sold to Oracle in 2016 after a heck of a run servicing the biggest brands on the internet. And we sold the company. And I ended up staying for about 3 years inside Oracle and really learned a lot. You know, kind of feel like I got my MBA at Oracle. You know, it was a very enterprise, giant juggernaut, you know, global 100 company. Reported to a guy who reported to Larry Ellison. So I had a lot of insights and experience there. But in parallel, Keith, I had been doing a lot of advising and independent board roles and doing some angel investing and pooling some capital with friends and creating different investment vehicles, running syndicates on AngelList. And so what I really realized is I'm a really good complement to technical founders. And when I created York IE, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be cool to be able to not just pick one tech startup and do that again for, but have a portfolio approach to business where we can make these capabilities and this advice and this counsel, this mentorship and guidance more repeatable, replicable across the portfolio. And so a lot of what we're building now in York IE is really the manifestation of the operating day job and the advising, investing, moonlight job and trying to smash those things together to form a new school company like York IE.
So you've been an entrepreneur for quite a while. How would you describe your time at Oracle? I mean, Oracle is very different. What did you learn there that you think was most helpful in terms of investing today?
Yeah, I think I'd say the number one thing that was most helpful is if you think of Oracle and you look at the last 20 years, they've been one of the most acquisitive companies of private companies and public companies in the history of business, right? So they've bought over 125 different technology companies over the years to become Oracle. Obviously, Oracle's rooted in the core database built for the CIA in the 70s. But over time, it's become a kind of really prolific cloud platform player across all different industries and layers of the technology stack. So I think the number one thing was every single company who was looking for an exit would go inbound to Oracle to see if they wanted to buy their company. So the amount of inbound deal flow that came into Oracle and to really learn and hone in on the process to evaluate acquisitions, M&A for Oracle was a big part of my job while we were there. We focused on all the modern cloud strategy. So platform data layer down to infrastructure. So think storage, compute, networking, real kind of deep tech stuff. Anything that came inbound to Oracle for M&A, my team evaluated, tried to find product sponsors, business sponsors, look at these deals. We looked at deals in the tens of billions of dollars. We looked at tuck-in deals, acquihires, and everything in between. So I think that process, methodology, thesis, alignment, writing up strategic rationales, pitching those rationales to the executive team all the way up to Safra Katz and Mark Hurd and Larry Ellison. It was baptism by fire. You come in from a startup and you know startups, and then all of a sudden you learn a lot about how companies make priorities short, mid, and long term. And I think that's a big part of our process today to evaluate opportunities, but also our investment thesis in general.
Have you had any mentors or people that you consider to be of significant influence in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say number one, I'm a child of my parents. My mother, very smart, savvy woman. She's the one who grew up in the family business, which was the shoe manufacturing business. And my dad married in, and he was this kind of tenacious, hardworking, former, star athlete. And so, I kind of have the mix of my mom's sort of thirst for learning and attention to education and intellect. And then my dad's scrappy hustle, hard work, integrity, go for it mantra. So I always start with that. I think everyone could say their parents, but I mean, I'm saying it not just in my upbringing, being a good upbringing and a well-rounded one, but also in the business, the family businesses that we grew up in, So from a business perspective, it was always stick it to the man, work for yourself, control your own destiny, deliver on your job and you'll eat a nice meal that night or go on a nice vacation that year. And I think that practicality of business is certainly lost in the Silicon Valley growth at all costs, venture capital game. So a lot of that foundation is, the manifestation of where I live today and work and how I think about York IE and the tech space. It's just let's get back to the basics of Main Street small business and, build good and healthy, sustainable companies. And then obviously I'm consistently studying the greatest in business of all time. I've had different obsessions over the years. Richard Branson's always one. I always think he, from the standpoint of vision and also working on stuff he likes to work on, it's kind of there's a lot of pride in that. I've had lots of great, founders I've worked with, that have been my CEOs, different board members, different VCs. But, I kind of keep my circle pretty tight. I have a really good team at York IE. I have a large family. And, I kind of try to bounce stuff off the people I trust, and that's reciprocated.
Let's start discussing York IE. Why don't we start with the investment thesis and how you're different than other VC firms?
Yeah, sure. So we are focused on exclusively B2B SaaS. So SaaS is software as a service for the audience. Recurring revenue businesses, early stage at the pre-seed, seed stage through Series A. We invest, what we say, up and down the stack. So what I mean by that is we'll invest in infrastructure technologies, cybersecurity, data, platform plays, all the way up through vertical applications and specific industries. We really like to look at things like the market in approach to company building. So we like to study markets, competitors, comparators, differentiation relative to the market, more so than many times you see the product out approach to company building. I think I have a good idea for a product. I'm going to build it and see if it sticks on the wall. We're very focused on founder market fit. So what's the founder's relevancy to the market in which they're building this technology? And again, I mentioned it already, but we look for pragmatic business models, thoughtful scaling plans, capital efficiency, even at the earliest stages. We hate when we see a pitch deck that says, here's all of our milestones and they're all capital raises, right? So we believe that the founder should treat the company like their baby and, build it their way. And we want to be a support mechanism for that. That's the thesis. I mean, it starts though at the top of funnel, Keith. We we put out a tremendous amount of content. I mean, we do interviews like this, right, on podcasts, and we put out lots of content, collateral, education, inspiration, curriculum on how to build and scale startup out into the world. And that drives a lot of inbound deal flow to our website. And so when we launched York IE, we were like, we wanted an ability to work and influence startups at any stage of the company lifecycle from a low touch to high touch way. Clearly, if we invest, it's pretty high touch, right? We're on the cap table. Many times we're on the board. We might have different governance rights and preferred stock. But we wanted to be able to have a mechanism to work with companies all the way to low touch, like listen to this podcast or subscribe to our newsletter or read our blog or follow us on social media. So we have a SaaS platform that's also a freemium approach, paid approach to that platform for teams and enterprises. And then we have a bunch of tech-enabled advisory services. So think like a Deloitte, McKinsey, Gartner model for how to build and scale a startup. So we have a bunch of different capabilities there. So any startup in the world, generally, whether we're investing in you or not, we have a way to engage. And that's the model in which we're going to market with.
What's your due diligence process like from, you know, beginning to end? You know, because companies that are interested in finding, you know, venture capital partners, right, always want to know, am I going to come out the other end of this, right? What's it going to take to get a close? So kind of tell us, you know, from, you know, how much time it takes and what they can expect going through it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that starts at the top of funnel. I just mentioned, you know, we see anywhere from 100 to 150 inbound opportunities per month of startups saying they're looking to raise capital. So what's that mean? You better stand out on the first introduction, right? Because that's a lot of companies to sift through and just even qualify whether you're a fit. I think also it's important that startups actually do a little research coming in the front door. We put all over our website, all over LinkedIn, all over any place, any podcast that we specialize in early stage, seed to series A, B2B SaaS businesses. Well, if you're looking for capital and you come to us, hopefully you're early stage B2B SaaS business because that's what we do, right? So we're able to sort of vet out that qualification at the very beginning. You know, 120 deals becomes 50 that actually are early stage B2B SaaS, you know, recurring revenue business models. And so from that, we run it through its process. We do first calls, we review pitch decks, we review flash financials, we make some calls into our network. Maybe it's our investors, maybe it's some of our employees, maybe it's some of our advisors to get a market perspective of those companies. We do several calls along the way. Typically, they're broken out between, you know, product and technology, financials and business model, team, kind of traction, overview, go-to-market, customer base. And these are sort of the five areas that we look at. And a lot of times we pull in different resources to evaluate. Different than a traditional venture fund model, typically what happens is all different partners of different funds are looking at all these different deals and they show up to a Monday partner meeting. And they say, hey, we think we might want to drop an LOI and get into some post-LOI due diligence before we close the deal. And then they kind of spar and squabble over it. Back to kind of borrowing a page from the Oracle model, we run our process more like almost like corporate development or corporate venture, where my team runs a series of different calls, collects a lot of notes, writes up draft investment rationales, brings companies through the gauntlet or the process. And then as the next stage unlocks, our VP gets pulled in. As the next stage unlocks, my co-founder and our chief investment officer, Joe Raska, gets pulled in. As the next stage unlocks, I get pulled in, right? So I'm probably only pulled into a handful of deals per month, and we're doing one to two deals per month, right? So I think it's a more methodical process where, in more efficient process for founders, where they're kind of cutting through the noise and they know that process up front. We're very transparent about it. You got to be a thesis match, but then you got to kind of get it through the gauntlet on all those key areas.
Let's talk briefly about a company that you participated in funding. It's called Vetro. Why don't you tell us?
I'm wearing the sweatshirt today too. That could have been intentional or unintentional. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, where they're based and what do they do?
Yes, so this is a cool company. They're out of Portland, Maine. So that's the other coast, not Portland, Oregon. Portland, Maine. Really well known for seafood and lobster, if you're ever out in the Maine area. But Portland has a really burgeoning tech ecosystem. There's been a boatload of investment up there, both from the public and private sectors of cool new software and technology companies. So Vetro is a GIS mapping technology. So what they do is they run a mapping infrastructure that helps carriers, municipalities, governments build and deploy modern networks, 5G fiber networks. So they're mapping guys. The founders, Will and Sean, came from mapping. So they're mapping experts, and they actually used to run an agency or a consulting shop that would use different, you know, off-the-shelf tools, Google Maps, Excel spreadsheets, to help these companies build out their networks. And so they decided to build a proprietary platform with a bunch of proprietary IP that does this in a self-serve and then layered on service basis. So it's a full-on SaaS business, growing really fast. We ended up investing in their seed round. I want to say probably must have been 2020 is my recollection. And they ended up raising a follow-on round of financing from Resolve Growth Partners later. So they've raised, I think, over $12 million now in funding, growing really fast, chasing down $10 million ARR. And, you know, just a really, really awesome, I mentioned earlier, our thesis, vertical software application. You know, they know their market. They know who they sell to. They know their repeatable use cases. They know their value prop for customers. They can create target lists, and they can set up BDRs and salespeople to go chase them and market to those audiences. There's lots of industry trade shows and events. And it's one of those, when you do vertical software applications, Keith, it's like, it's kind of like when you win pillar clients, it helps you win the next clients. It's kind of like a fear of missing out or a FOMO strategy to go to market. And that's what I love about vertical applications. It's a point and shoot go to market model, and you just got to execute and continue to thrive. So we have a very engaged relationship with them. One of my partners is on the board. We've helped them on advisory services, everything from capital strategy to financial operations to marketing and communications and go-to-market strategies. And, you know, it's just one of those great engagements that's working, and the company's growing and healthy, and we're really excited to see where they take it.
What was your, how did you get introduced to them? And what was that like, your initial discussions with them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to look, it's precisely the intro, but the, I remember the, we've been doing a lot of networking in this kind of main ecosystem. The main venture fund, the main technology institute, the Rue Institute, which is associated with Northeastern University. These are like kind of fixture mainstay organizations in the main technology ecosystem. And so I believe we're actually introduced to them through the main venture fund or one of the firms there. We had actually done a deal prior to Vetro in a company called Defendify, which is a SMB, small business cybersecurity platform. And we shared an investor there. So that's how we got introduced and connected to them. You know, a lot of these things are interesting. They're nuanced. They take a few calls to kind of learn. These guys were making a transition from their old business, which was more of a services model, pay for time consultancy on how to build out these networks, to this SaaS transition. So a lot of our favorite companies, it takes a little bit to learn about them, are the ones that are making that transition, because they've clearly proven they can build a good business in services, but they realize the scale potential of that business is limited by their time, right? So, you know, those are really great companies, already proven a market need, already showed demand, and are trying to think of how do we create enterprise value and scale? And the way to do that's through software, right? And data platforms. And so that's what they were doing. So that was, I remember the very beginning parts of our due diligence was like, is this even a SaaS business? Like, are they serious about this transition? Do they have any initial proof points that are proving the market's ready to buy through a subscription model or not? We did a lot in this one on market tailwinds. So think like federal funding going toward future infrastructure builds and deployments. Billions and billions and billions of dollars of federal money has been going into these areas, getting earmarked in these areas. So that was another tailwind for us. And just the legacy players, the tools that historically were used outside of cobbling together the off-the-shelf kind of stuff or general stuff was very antiquated technologies that we thought there was a great opportunity. So sometimes in these businesses, they're disrupting existing markets. Sometimes they're making their own market you know, really at the end of the day, as you know, it just comes down to really solid execution. And, you know, we believed in the team and they've been proving it so far.
How did you determine they were a good fit as an investment? And what I'm trying to get at is this. In other words, you look at a lot of different companies, you spend a lot of time, and there's the economics and whether or not you feel they can execute. But do you also keep in the back of your mind that York IE is looking to build a portfolio of certain types of companies?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're spot on. I mean, we can talk thesis all day on like, how do you qualify if someone like generally fits?
Right.
Then you're getting down into those five key areas and you're like sort of stack racking up, but no one's 100% performer in all five areas. Right. I mean, even at scale, you know, watch an earnings call and no one's getting, you know, A++ on every area of their business, right, as a public company. So bring that all the way down to startups and they're like Swiss cheese, right? You know, there's holes everywhere and you're trying to just determine what you think. So I think at the end of the day for us, yeah, there's terms, there's valuation, there's governance structure, there's board, there's all those things. But I think we look at it a little bit more differently. We're because we don't come from like financial services or VC or PE or banking backgrounds, we come from more the operator side. I think a lot of times we have to put ourselves in their shoes to say, do we think we can help this company scale to be a bigger company and a bigger success story? Is there enough here operationally that we believe this company can execute and that we can be additive on that growth journey? It's a more operator lens than straight like financial portfolio engineering or financial engineering lens. A lot of that comes down to intuition, experience, both from being active operators, but also just working and evaluating so many startups over the last 15, 20 years, right? I mean, at this stage, I've probably looked at, you know, 5,000 companies and worked intimately with hundreds of them to determine and study business models and scaling opportunities and plans. And, you know, so you do end up coming down to like gut feel. I'll give you an example. There's a deal, we haven't closed it yet. We just dropped the term sheet to lead their seed round. And it was a company out of New York. And we went through the process and we ended up saying no. It was a young founder, a couple of young founders. We thought they were a little too green. We thought their business model was a little, their financial models were a little thin in their maturity. We didn't quite believe in their traction growth rates, like where they're going next year, the year after. It just felt like it was, you know, just not quite strong enough. And we ended up saying, you know, we got so many other great deals. Sometimes it's just that, right? We have so many other great deals in the pipeline. And we went and we said, no, we said, we're not going to do this deal. And to the founder's credit, he was like, I'm not going to take no for an answer. And he said, I'd like to get together in person. And I guess karma happened that we were going to be in New York the next week. So we went down to New York and we met with him and we dropped the term sheet on him at the end of the last week, you know, because in that meeting, he came so prepared with all the areas that we thought he was thin or maybe scoring a little lower on or that or our concerns. And he was able to give us a really clear narrative on what he was doing in those areas to move himself forward and why we should believe in him and his team and why he thought we were the best partner for him. He didn't want just a check writer or a VC who had never lived a day in his shoes. He needed our support and our infrastructure and resources to help. And we ended up doing the deal. So hopefully that gives you another like lens into like, these things aren't always black and white. You know, we have a lot of companies we haven't chosen to invest in that we've regretted after, you know, they've gone on and done very well. This is the nature of the game when you have such a wide swath of companies and a big top of funnel to evaluate and make decisions on and a limited capital pool. I mean, we are methodical. We do 15 to 20 B2B software investments a year. We have a growing capital pool. We're just under about 20 million a year. We call it an evergreen syndicate model. So it's not the same as a fund construct, which we could get into, but it literally is 20 deals a year broken down into 2 6-month windows. And we have a budget every 6 months about how much capital we have to deploy. It's not never ending. So we can't do every deal we see. So I think that that kind of running it like a company with a budget, with a strong thesis, keeps us in our lanes really, really well.
What's your typical process like in terms of you issue a term sheet to a company and you say, we're interested in, you know, funding X amount of dollars. What can a company expect? What is it you're going to ask from them to evaluate more specifically as you start to get into the details of the transaction?
That's a great question. So it's a little different for the earliest stage. I feel like you end up process-wise getting a lot more depth of intel before a term sheet than you might later stage or even in M&A settings, right? Like, so by the time we would issue a term sheet, or maybe let's say someone else has already issued a term sheet and we're participating, it's probably like half and half, you know, half we're issuing the term sheet, half some other firm is, and we're thinking of participating, right? But we do so much of the work and the deep dives before the term sheet that honestly, by the time it goes to term sheet, it tends to just be, now we're just drafting legal docs and agreeing on making sure, memorializing the terms and term sheet, make it into the corporate bylaws and you know, the cap tables, right? And all the right legal documentations all put together, if that makes sense. Again, I think that kind of shifts as you get later and later stage companies, only in that they end up being different company profiles. And, you know, you see a lot more post LOI diligence in those deals. So by the time we get there, you know, we've already done product demos, roadmap reviews, all the technology kind of moat discovery. We've already gone into the go-to-market motion, into the customer base, probably talked to a couple customers, got a real picture. We've already dug into the financial model, into the bottoms up side of the financial model, both the top line and the expense side. We've already dug into the team, maybe even done some back channeling on them and the market and what we know, right? So much happens for us before the LOI that it kind of becomes a formality once the LOI is issued that we're just moving to close. And it's more legal and tax work that happens to get that done.
If you can recall with regard to Vetro, what was the biggest challenge, if any, that you had in getting that closed?
Yeah, I think it's tricky when companies are moving from a services business, a healthy services business. Services businesses get a different multiple on revenue for their valuation than a SaaS business. A reason for that is services is time-based, usually lower margin, usually less sticky, meaning it's not recurring. It's not necessarily, you have to win it every year. Or a software business, you know, if you sign up a subscription to HubSpot or Salesforce or Amazon, you know, or Netflix, if it's personal, right? You're paying for that and it's auto-renewing annually or monthly as you go. Those businesses have higher margin, 70%+ gross margin. They're more predictable businesses. So I think for Vetro is really tricky to give them credit for the business they had built on the services side, but also, you know, we were investing in the software business and the shift and the recommitment to recurring revenue SaaS, right? So how do you value that at the early stage, right? How do you put a value on that enables when you put in, you know, $500,000 or $1 million check, how much ownership are we taking for that? How big should the round be? What should the board be after the round? I think a lot of it, once we got through, yeah, we want to invest in it, ended up being the deal construct, the amount of money to raise, the valuation, the terms, the board, the governance. And, you know, these are a lot of sometimes tough conversations and everybody's coming at them with different motivations. And I think in the end, you know, you need to align those things as best as possible. What I always tell founders is whenever you raise capital, you're actually selling a little bit of your company to an outsider. You better be sure you're going into that like a marriage and that you have, with all best intentions, have high confidence you're going to stay together, you know? And I feel like too often in the culture that's being created, it's like, it's just about raising money and people just need the money to deploy and put the work. And they don't treat themselves, their company, like they're the free agent. You know, they need to like flip the script, and like there's too much fanfare and vanity around the VCs. And it's like, at the end of the day, like you can choose who your investors are. And that's hopefully how our founders feel positive about working with us.
It's actually great advice to give to founders. What advice would you give to other investors that are potential co-investors?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the stage, right? But I think universal advice is sort of know your role. You know, I think at the end of the day, it's so hard to build a company and be an operator. And for companies to continue to grow efficiently, effectively, to get to scale, to get to an ultimate monetization event, whether that's an IPO or selling to a private equity firm or exiting to a strategic like Oracle. It's such a squiggly line to get there, and it never goes as planned, right? But very often, venture capitalists are, legacy, in their experience, they've been MBAs or they've, worked in financial services, or they've been a banker, they've been a management consultant, and very few have actually worked a day in the shoes of the operator. And there's no like perfect playbook, right? So you can study case studies all day in business school. You can sit on boards and try to pattern map to other companies. But at the end of the day, every company is incredibly unique, and you need to sort of bob and weave and support them and figure out what they need to grow. And I think there's a way to do that that's more collaborative and doesn't create undue, unnecessary added pressure to the founders and executive teams that you back. And what I've just seen so much, so many companies end up sort of stumbling or staggering under the weight and the pressure that they feel from their VC investors, because the VC investor's client is their investors, right? They're limited partners, and they have a fiduciary duty to those investors. They're, in essence, bankers. They're managing money, right? And I just think the incentives can become pretty misaligned. And they just got to remember that, like, these operators are like, the company doesn't exist or work or do anything without them. So you got to try to create an environment and a halo for them where they feel safe and comfortable, not in fear there all the time. And again, that's not a universal truth, right? There's great investors who have never been operators, right? There's operators who have become investors and stink at it, right? So, but on the margin, I think it's like, at the end of the day, we can't do anything as investors or the York IE advisory business if we don't have great teams and leaders to back. So prop them up, make them feel confident, and continue to operate with high conviction, and be their support blanket. And I just think sometimes that isn't the way it goes. And I've lived it, right? I mean, we raised $100 million of outside capital, predominantly later. We actually bootstrapped Dyn, our company, to $30 million before we ever raised a dollar. When we did, we were left alone for a while until we became like this pre-IPO darling, or we're going to be a big exit to someone like an Oracle someday. And I think it got really, really hard. And I feel like the investors and the independent board members didn't necessarily make life easier for us at all times. And again, we can be challenged. I get that. You should challenge founders, but do so from an aligned place is the number one advice I give.
Great. Kyle, thank you so much for sharing your time and your experience. How may our audience get in touch with you if they're interested in being part of York IE as an investor, co-investor, if they're seeking capital?
Yeah, or advisory services. We can work with anyone out there. So please visit us at york.ie is our website. Across all social channels, we're at York Growth. You can find me on social channels at kyork20. And so we're everywhere. Subscribe to our blog, and our newsletters, follow along, and hopefully you glean some inspiration and support on your journey.
Great. We really appreciate you being here. Wish you the best with York IE. You got a lot going on there, and we know you're going to do well. So thanks again. That's it for today's interview. If you're a VC firm or tech company founder and you'd like to share your interesting story, please visit us at fundingdisrupting.com, where you may learn more about the podcast and appear on our show. Until next time, keep funding and disrupting.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Funding and Disrupting. Don't forget to visit our sponsor, AuraCo.com, to learn more about working directly with Aura Collective's exclusive technology PR team. They'll help you craft your message, get noticed in the press, and help you get your venture to the funding finish line. Again, you can visit them at www.auraco.com. Keep funding and keep disrupting.